Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Tragic accounts of state-sponsored abductions and enforced disappearances in the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, DPRK, require action from the country's authorities, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk, said on Tuesday. A new report by the UN Human Rights Office details enforced disappearances and abductions dating back to 1950. Heartbreaking testimony from some 80 victims shows how the crimes have caused long-lasting trauma, said UN Rights Chief Turk, who added that entire generations of families have lived with the grief of not knowing the fate of spouses, parents, children, and siblings. Mr. Turk stated that enforced disappearance is a profound violation of many rights at once, and responsibility lies with the state. He called on the DPRK, more commonly known as North Korea, to acknowledge and resolve the cases and to work with the UN on solutions to these and other pressing human rights issues. Mr. Turk also echoed the report's urgent call for truth, justice, and reparations for victims. Even in decades-old cases, we should leave no stone unturned in seeking accountability, transparency, and redress, he said. Hundreds of thousands of workers in Turkey and Syria lost livelihoods in the deadly February earthquakes, and social justice concerns are rising fast, the UN International Labour Organization, ILO, said on Tuesday. Initial data from Turkey show that the earthquake left more than 658,000 workers unable to earn a living. Take-home pay has dropped by around $150 million per month in affected Turkish areas, too. In Syria, 170,000 have lost their jobs, and the income losses are estimated at $5.7 million a month. Here's ILO's Maurizio Bussi, director of the Priority Action Program on Decent Work in Crises.
Another part of the risks that we are highlighting in the report is the possible surfacing of child labor situations in both countries, because obviously families, they have to compensate on their income. The other dimension is that schools are still closed or malfunctioning, and obviously access to education becomes an issue.
The UN Labour Agency is working in both countries to support jobs and reconstruction grounded in the principles of decent work, skills development, and occupational safety and health. To El Salvador, where a year since the introduction of a state of emergency in response to gang violence, the measures continue to raise serious concerns, the UN Rights Office, OHCHR, said on Tuesday. At least 65,000 people have been detained since the special measures were introduced, and 90 people have allegedly died in custody, amid reports of prisoners' rights violations. Some of these mass detentions, including of children, may amount to arbitrary detention, as they appear to be based on poorly substantiated investigations on crude profiling of those detained, OHCHR said. With more, here's OHCHR spokesperson Marta Hurtado.
We call on the authorities in El Salvador to ensure people are not arrested without sufficient legal authorization and ensure that those detained are afforded all fundamental safeguards as required under international human rights law.
The right to life, the absolute prohibition of torture, and the presumption of innocence apply at all times, even during declared states of emergency, Ms. Hurtado insisted. Dominika Tomaszewska-Mortimer, UN News.
Coming to you live from Northeast Jefferson County, Kansas, your one true voice in Kansas, this is Radio Free Kansas.
Good afternoon, listeners. We are headed to a warm day and warmer days ahead here on this broadcast, March 29th of 2023. I'm your host, Mike Adell. I hope you're having a good day, a good lunch time here in Northeast Kansas. I know I am enjoying the weather. The weather is absolutely gorgeous. Sunny and 49 degrees, expected to get to a high of around 51 to 52 degrees this afternoon. And we have a few more chilly days ahead, but it looks like in the forecast for the next 3 days, we may get up as high as at least the computer models say, up to almost 70 degrees in the next coming days ahead. Headlines still continue with Democracy Now, but coming up in the second hour, and I always find Maria Gilardin standing.
Britain will send depleted uranium munitions to Ukraine.
While depleted uranium shells are technically not nuclear weapons, they are hazardous. The exploding shell can spread them in the air to over 25 miles, or 40 kilometers, and these can be easily inhaled in the form of dust. Depleted uranium has a half-life of over 4 billion years.
On the next broadcast of TUC Radio.
That's coming in the second hour following Alex Smith's Radio EcoShock. Gilardin always has some timely stuff pertaining to current events in the world today. Now coming up, the headlines from this morning. I lucked out. I got it today. This is today's headlines at Democracy Now!
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Mexico, hundreds of asylum seekers gathered in Ciudad Juarez Tuesday demanding justice after at least 38 people were killed during a fire at an immigration detention jail just feet from the border with El Paso, Texas. Over two dozen others were seriously injured. The blaze Monday broke out after dozens of migrants set their mattresses on fire protesting their deportations as well as abusive and inhumane conditions at the overcrowded jail run by Mexico's National Migration Institute. Surveillance footage released Tuesday also shows guards quickly walking away when the fire started, making no attempt to release the migrants as flames and smoke engulfed their cells. At least 28 of the victims were from Guatemala, according to officials, while others killed and injured were from Venezuela, Honduras, El Salvador, Colombia, and Ecuador. This is Daniela Marquez, an asylum seeker from Venezuela, at yesterday's protest in Ciudad Juarez.
We demand justice for those who were inside the migration center. They had been there inside for a month. They cried out of hunger because they didn't give them food. It's not fair, honestly. The victims have families. Their mothers are in Venezuela. How is that possible that their mothers have to cry for them that far away? It's not fair, honestly. I don't have the words to express what I feel, honestly.
After headlines, we'll go to Ciudad Juarez, Mexico for more. More information has emerged about the Nashville school shooter who killed six people Monday, three of them 9-year-old children. This is Nashville Police Chief John Drake.
We've determined that Audrey bought seven firearms from five different local gun stores here legally. They were legally purchased. Three of those weapons were used yesterday during this horrific tragedy. She was under care, doctor's care, for an emotional disorder. Law enforcement knew nothing about the treatment she was receiving, but her parents felt that she should not own weapons.
A motive for the massacre has not yet been identified. Police body camera footage shows Nashville officers stopping the rampage 4 minutes after arriving on the scene. The police response has been compared to last year's mass shooting at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas, where officers waited for well over an hour before confronting the shooter, while 21 people, including 19 children, were massacred, almost all of them Latinx. Russia says it's begun drills with its Yars intercontinental ballistic missile system in a show of military might. Meanwhile, Ukraine's received a first shipment of Leopard and Challenger armored tanks from Germany and Britain amid intense fighting in the country's east. The head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi, is visiting the site of Europe's largest nuclear power plant in Zaporizhzhia today. President Volodymyr Zelensky told Rossi the safety at the nuclear power station cannot be guaranteed as long as it remains under Russia occupation in what he called Moscow's radiation blackmail. Grossi said Tuesday talks to stem the risks of a nuclear disaster are ongoing.
It might be possible to establish some form of protection, perhaps not emphasizing so much the idea of a zone, but on the protection itself, what people should do or shouldn't do to protect instead of having a territorial concept.
In Russia, a man whose 13-year-old daughter drew an anti-war picture at school was sentenced to 2 years in prison in a case that sparked international outrage. Alexei Moskalyov, however, has apparently escaped his house arrest, and authorities said Tuesday his whereabouts are unknown. His daughter, whose drawing featured a Ukrainian mother and child under a barrage of missiles, was removed from her home and put in a shelter. The owner of The Guardian issued an apology Tuesday for the British newspaper's founder's role in transatlantic slavery. The Scott Trust published research that shows Guardian founder John Edward Taylor and investors gained much of their wealth from the cotton trade after importing the cotton from North America, where it was cultivated by enslaved Africans on plantations. The findings came as part of an independent investigation commissioned in late 2020 by the Scott Trust. The Guardian also announced a 10-year, $12 million restorative justice program, which includes supporting black journalists. British Nigerian historian and member of the Scott Trust, David Olusoga, is featured in a video as part of The Guardian's report, as well as a written piece in which he describes how British ties to the transatlantic slave trade have been obfuscated.
The Guardian, like thousands of institutions in Britain, has direct financial connections to the world of slavery. That reality can't be negotiated with. It can't be explained away. This history can never be solved, can never be remedied, but it can be, something good can come from it, but it needs to be a dialogue.
In Burma, the ruling military junta dissolved 40 political parties, including Aung San Suu Kyi's NLD party. NLD and others did not meet a registration deadline for the yet-to-be-scheduled election, which most civilian parties deem illegitimate. 77-year-old Aung San Suu Kyi was deposed and arrested in February 2021 military coup and is now serving prison sentences totaling 33 years. The UN reports the humanitarian and human rights crisis in Burma is continuing to deteriorate with mass arrests, torture of prisoners, the killing of civilians, and media repression. Back in the United States, in Idaho, the State House passed a bill that would criminalize the act of helping someone under the age of 18 obtain an abortion in another state without parental consent. The bill is now headed to the Idaho Senate, where it's also expected to pass. Almost all abortions are now illegal in Idaho following the repeal of Roe v. Wade. With the proposed measure, state Republicans created a new crime, so-called abortion trafficking, with penalties of 2 to 5 years in prison. The legislation also applies to mail-order medication abortions, meaning an older relative who drives a minor to the post office to pick up a package containing abortion pills could end up in prison. A federal judge has reportedly ordered former Vice President Mike Pence to testify to the grand jury investigating Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 election. Special Counsel Jack Smith, who's overseeing the grand jury, subpoenaed Pence earlier this year. While the judge ruled executive privilege does not shield Pence from testifying, Pence could avoid certain lines of questioning thanks to a constitutional clause known as speech or debate that's intended to protect lawmakers from some forms of legal action. Pence could still appeal the judge's decision. Meanwhile, former National Enquirer publisher David Pecker testified again this week before the Manhattan grand jury looking into alleged hush money payments made to Stormy Daniels during Trump's 2016 campaign. Pecker said to have helped broker the deal between Daniels and Trump's former fixer, Michael Cohen. The Washington Post reporting Ginni Thomas, wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, collected nearly $600,000 in anonymous donations for a conservative group called Crowdsourcers for Culture and Liberty. It's not the first time Ginni and Clarence Thomas have come under scrutiny for conflict of interest issues. In 2020, Ginni Thomas urged White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows to pursue efforts to overturn Donald Trump's election loss and pressured officials in Arizona and Wisconsin to choose pro-Trump electors. Justice Thomas was the sole dissenter in the Supreme Court's 8-1 decision that led to the release of White House documents around January 6. In other news from Washington, President Biden and Republicans remain at odds over how to handle the debt ceiling, as Republican House Speaker Kevin McCarthy requested a meeting with Biden Tuesday to push for spending cuts before agreeing to raise the debt limit. The White House and Democrats have rejected this idea. Republicans agreed to raising the debt ceiling with no conditions 3 times during Trump's presidency. Yesterday, advocacy groups joined with progressive lawmakers to demand Republicans stop cutting essential social services, including Medicare and the food assistance program SNAP, which was recently slashed after being increased during the pandemic. This is April Lewis from Action North Carolina.
Conservatives are trying to increase costs, paperwork, and bureaucracy that will only put families like mine at risk of losing access to food assistance and increasing the risk of homelessness because the same conservatives are increasing costs for low-income families by protecting tax loopholes for the wealthy. These wealthy stakeholders and corporations should pay their fair share, and by reversing the Trump tax cuts, alone would save $2 trillion.
And a Maryland appeals court has reinstated the murder conviction of Adnan Syed. Less than 6 months after prosecutors in Baltimore dropped charges against him last October, asserting he was wrongly convicted. Syed was released from prison in September following 23 years behind bars for the 1999 murder of his ex-girlfriend, Haemin Lee. The appeals court Tuesday ordered a new hearing on Syed's conviction, saying the rights of Haemin Lee's brother, Young Lee, had been violated when he wasn't given adequate notice to travel from California to attend last year's proceedings in Maryland in person. The case gained national attention in 2014 when it was featured on the hugely popular podcast Serial. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Hey, what a great synopsis of world headlines. Oh, Amy missed reading protests and strikes conducted by the people of France are continuing, and BBC and Reuters have continuous live streams of these protests. I think this one will be the last one today, and I think they're anticipating the next one in very early April. All right, now on with the latest, absolute latest, Radio Eco Shock by Alex Smith. It's from the world's largest archives of environmental radio shows. It's broadcast on over 105 radio stations.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
Can crisis tip us into an ecologically sane civilization? UK think tank report author Lori Leyburn on a future where disasters ripple across the world. Then let's get away to Antarctica. Why did sea ice crash around that frozen continent? And increasing El Nino events may drive global sea levels higher? Australian scientist Adrian Purick shares big changes at the South Pole. Welcome. This is Radio Eco Shock. Two things I find most annoying in climate speak, talking about 1.5 degrees C of warming, as though that is still possible, and assuming humans will build back better no matter how many times disasters strike. A new UK think tank report tackles both. They find a looming risk of falling into, quote, a climate doom loop. The researchers come from two well-known quarters, the Institute for Public Policy Research and Chatham House, both in the UK. They question whether the grand transformation of energy and consumption, well, everything, can actually happen in a warming world. Stalling could mean we fail, becoming ruled by a continuing stream of disasters. One of the thought leaders in this process is Lori Leyburn. Lori is a visiting fellow at both think tanks, as well as the Global Systems Institute at the University of Exeter. He appears often in European publications, TV, and radio. Lori Leyburn, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock. Well, let's start with a factoid. Loretta Heber-Girardet at the United Nations Office of Disaster Risk Reduction was presenting in a panel you moderated last June. It was part of London Climate Action Week. Loretta said by 2030, global disasters could increase by 40%. This amounts to 540 disasters every year, more than 1.5 a day. It's more than any of us can absorb or the news can report, and just 7 years away, according to the UN. Lori Leyburn, what do you think it would be like living in such a disastrous time coming right up?
It would be very distracting in an immensely tragic way. The resources of states, of communities, of companies would be increasingly absorbed by having to go into crisis management mode and respond to those types of conditions. It wouldn't be a world that has become critically fractured in the sense of there have been irreversible and catastrophic changes to the environment. Those changes are looming on the horizon, though. It's a world basically that looks like what we have seen recently, but much worse. It's a world, therefore, in which we will have to have very robust abilities and focused on not being overwhelmed by those symptoms, by those disasters, and staying focused on the root cause, on getting carbon emissions down and restoring nature.
How do you define the word disaster?
I think there are a wide range of things that we could call disasters in the context of the climate and ecological crisis. In a direct sense, we can think of the storms or heat shocks that we have seen in recent decades and that the scientific community has told us have increased markedly as a result of the climate and ecological crisis. But we also need to expand our definitions to more indirect effects. By that I mean the storms or heat extremes and so on, then leading to impacts on the food system, like a reduction in crops, which then lead to an increase in price, which then leads to the knock-on impact of affecting the ability of people to afford food and the cost of living increasing, which then can have knock-on impacts into, say, political stability, to social cohesion, to poverty, development outcomes. And it's those types of cascading impacts that we need to start to put at the forefront of our understanding of what we mean by climate shocks or climate disasters, what we mean by the consequences of this climate and ecological crisis.
Well, as I said at the beginning, many scientists and activists sniff at 1.5 degrees C of warming as an illusion, a goal in the rearview mirror. But your group found danger lurking in the idea of giving up that low goal. How so?
Well, we think the 1.5 goal has been a good motivator in many ways to date. It's provided a focus to climate action, a tangible goal, a number, which I think has helped focus minds. Before, that number was ill-defined and then was 2 degrees, which we know is even more dangerous and risky and deadly than even 1.5. As we head into the future, as we get closer to 1.5 and people begin to cast doubt on whether 1.5 is possible, we will have to seek similar motivators. At the end of the day, what we need is to deliver the huge transformations that you alluded to in your introduction, the changes to our financial systems, transport systems, and so on. And that, at the end of the day, is what we need. Ideally, it would have happened, and we would have limited to 1.1, 1.2 like we are now. Ideally, it would have happened, or it would be in train so that we got a likelihood of limiting to 1.5. This is not 1.5. It's got to be whatever smallest increment degree we limit to. The question is then, what kind of stories are best to motivate those transformational changes? That's what we're interested in.
The UN also said, at the same time disasters are increasing because of climate change, vulnerability is also increasing. Could you talk about that?
So, a quick definition. When we talk about the risks from the climate ecological crisis, we think in terms of the hazards, so that those storms, waves, or the knock-on impacts like I was talking about with the food system, and then people's exposure to them and their vulnerability. Countries, for example, that rely on food imports a lot, they spend a lot, say, of their national wealth and on bringing that food into the country. They are particularly exposed and maybe vulnerable to shockwaves that filter through the food system. And ways that you can improve or reduce your vulnerability is, for example, to have a food system that might be more local, or a food system globally that's more equitable, that doesn't lead to so much wastage. It doesn't mean that those who have more wealth and power in the global economy can sometimes hoard or divert food stocks. So those are the kind of things that we could use to reduce vulnerability to some of these shocks.
Surprisingly, Loretta Heber-Girade from the UN also warned, quote, where we are seeing the greatest impact is through these high-frequency, low-intensity, but very, very regular events at the community and the local level. So it's not just the big disasters that make the news that count, but repeated changes around us?
Exactly. It's death by a million cuts is a unattractive phrase, but this is essentially what is happening, that chronic shifts in rainfall patterns, in temperature, and so on, are the types of shifting baseline that could be really deadly for crop suitability or for certain ecosystems, which lead to then less abundant animals, of insects and so on, which will then have knock-on impact, say, for food, and more, you know, extreme persistent changes in certain weather. So basically it's that grinding change into less habitable conditions that we're beginning to see all over the world. And as you say, often media coverage of the climate ecological crisis fixates on the big storm, the city leveling impact, whereas actually it is the day-to-day shift away from a habitable, accommodative environment that is the one of the main features of how the climate and ecological crisis is making a less stable, more deadly world.
Well, I'd like to take an example from nature. Experts tell us fires are part of the forest ecology in Western North America. The trees have evolved to recover. They have strategies. But Canadian fire expert Michael Flanagan told us on radio two cases there are where forests do not return. The first is a fire so hot that the soil is sterilized, and the second is when wildfires return to the same place within 5 years, killing off young trees before they seed. Could human civilization be the same, rebuilding after one disaster but unable to continue after repeated hits?
I think one of the features of recent times, the last few decades, has been the improvement in disaster monitoring, anticipation, and then preemption. We are seeing far fewer fatalities in regions that are being impacted, say, by more extreme hurricanes or other types of storms. And that's a very welcome development. Into the future, if we do not get on top of the temperature rise globally, it does start to stretch credibility that we will be able to continue that ability to preempt the severe and deadly impacts of certain disasters and impacts. Basically, our ability to adapt or to be resilient is in some ways and definitely could be outpaced by the acceleration of escalating climate and ecological impacts. And really, we are now in the situation where we need to consider the resilience of societies in the round. We should be doing that off the back of global shocks like the COVID-19 pandemic. We definitely need that in anticipation of an era in which we'll experience far more instability, and we need to make sure that we don't get overwhelmed by that instability, because at the end of the day, we have to deal with its root causes, or else we are stuck in that vicious circle.
Extreme events not seen before can also damage people's sense of immunity. A whole generation no longer trusts their environment, their city, or their homes. They don't feel safe. Some will have post-traumatic stress disorder. Even developed countries haven't developed treatment for a whole population that gets traumatized. As we break the climate, is anyone looking into a kind of mass trauma care?
There's a established area of study and practice on so-called climate anxiety. It has other names as well. That has largely grown out of observing high, even acute levels of anxiety in children who are essentially anticipating a much harder future that they will be by the end of their long lives relative to older generations they will be disproportionately exposed to. And in general, we need to expand our understanding of resilience, or in the climate jargon, adaptation, to respect those types of emotional, psychological, mental health impacts that we are experiencing and the world will experience more severely into the future. As with all of this, there are places that have been in a acutely destabilized state now for a very long time, those that we often describe as being on the climate front line. And they have rich lessons around, well, warnings of some of the what these impacts could look like as we head towards more of a global scale of similar destabilization and what we can do about it. But at the end of the day, governments in particular need to understand that resilience isn't just about building flood barriers or cities that can handle extreme heat. It's about ensuring societies overall are robust to being in this new climate that is being made so that they can, as I said, not become distracted and overwhelmed by it to the detriment of dealing with its root causes.
What did your research find about cascading effects of climate-driven disasters? How do the impacts spread out over space and time?
Let's use an example that was in the news a couple of years back. The so-called heat dome that impacted North America in, I think, the summer of 2021 got a lot of coverage, at least in Western media. The main focus of that coverage was the near total destruction of Lytton, the village of Canada, which was almost completely destroyed by wildfires caused by the heat effects, extreme heat. What got less coverage was how the destruction of the local ecology of trees and other plants meant that those roots were not really holding the land in place. So when later in the winter, extreme rainfall came, probably maybe driven by the climate crisis itself, it then washed away some of that land, which damaged railways and roads, which then had a knock-on impact for Canada's trade, which was already suffering from the consequences of the COVID-19 pandemic and the impacts of that on international trade, which then would have rippled out, the effects of Canada's trade being disrupted would have rippled out into the wider trade system globally and interacted with other countries that are experiencing their own problems. That is a good example of that type of cascade dynamic and a good example of how our attention is often on the first step of that cascade and less so on the ripple effect. And it's that ripple effect that is already deadly and will become more dangerous as we head into a climate destabilized future.
I lived through that heat dome, and we were hiding out in the basement trying to stay cool with air cleaners running to get the wildfire smoke out of the air. You told the BBC we are spending too much time mopping the floor to deal with the leak. What did you mean?
We are already having to face so many climate shocks and destabilizing impacts that are linked to the worsening climate and ecological crisis. And that may distract us, may be distracting us from reducing emissions, from pushing the changes in societies that will reduce emissions, that will restore nature. An example of this dynamic is if you look back just over a year ago to Putin's invasion of Ukraine. The weekend that happened and he was making veiled nuclear threats, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, released one of its latest reports with some very strident warnings. And, of course, the media coverage was fixated on that invasion by Russia at the detriment of the coverage of this deeper long-term problem. Into the future, you could imagine a situation in which the world has become more conflicted, partly because of pressures on food, on water availability, on other key measures of stability. And the news coverage, the political attention, the resources will be focused on dealing with the immediate effects of that instability, on having to respond to potential instances of conflict and so on, at the cost of everyone cooperating globally to get emissions down at the pace and scale that we need to do to avoid the most catastrophic climate and ecological impacts over this century.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Laurie Leyburn from Chatham House and the Institute for Public Policy Research, the UK Progressive Think Tank. We're talking about falling into the climate doom loop and how to avoid that. In recent years, many countries worst hit by big disasters were least able to afford to do much about them. Pakistan endured major floods, but the country's finances are on life support from the World Bank. We recently heard about extreme heat and drought hitting crops in Argentina, another nation close to bankruptcy. Will failure to recover affect the world economy and people in developed nations?
I would say in some ways that might have already happened. We are linked, all of us, by interconnected financial, economic, social, political systems. COVID was a tragic and rude proof of that, that a health emergency in one place very quickly became not just a health emergency, but also a economic and political and social emergency all over the place. Pakistan, the Pakistan government at last year's UN climate conference had a strapline that it had on one of its stalls in the exhibition space that said, what happens in Pakistan does not stay in Pakistan. The knock-on impacts economically in the financial system, say, from the, I would say, world historic flooding that Pakistan experienced will have had some impact, in the same way that the extreme heat and drought that hit India earlier in 2022 disrupted its ability to follow through on its promises to make up for the shortfall in food production that had occurred as a result of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, which is a major part of the global food system. It's really important for us, particularly in Western countries, to understand that the climate and ecological crisis isn't something that happens over there or can be isolated over there, and by that I mean in countries across the global south. It is something that impacts us all, in the same way that the failure to provide vaccines to countries across the global south in the context of the COVID-19 pandemic increased the chance of spread and therefore mutation that could blow back on wealthy nations. The same dynamic exists with the climate and ecological crisis. We're as strong as our weakest member in a globalized, interconnected economy if you allow certain places to fall into strife and destabilization. Everyone will suffer the consequences. And the ultimate endpoint of that dynamic is that globally, we are not able to reduce emissions down to the point where we stop this spiral.
And as you say, it's not as though climate disasters arrive in an otherwise normal world. The UK recently counted another 138,000 new COVID-19 infections in a single day. The American Center for Disease Control just admitted about 1 in 5 people who had been infected with COVID have lasting effects. Millions have long COVID. I just worry that this will weaken our ability to transform anything away from the fossil-powered economy.
That's the concern, that in a world beset by multiple interrelating problems, pandemics meet climate shocks to the food system, meet record mistrust in politics, partly driven by digital technology, in that kind of swirling vortex of problems and distractions that are exacerbating each other, yeah, the concern is that that is just simply too overwhelming. But crucially, in moments of instability and flux, we can drive rapid positive change. That is something that we see persistently throughout history. And in some ways, it may have been the case that, well, it didn't have to be the case that it got this bad before stuff really started to change, but that has to be the case now. Crises cannot be let to go to waste in the sense that the old definition of crisis, that it is a turning point. And in 2007, 2008, off the back of the financial crisis that happened there, we didn't get a so-called green recovery. With COVID, it's been a bit more ambiguous. I look to the US and its Inflation Reduction Act, as well as its other big spending bits of legislation recently, as an example of how governments can rally to recognize that in the context of instability and a crisis, you can start to push the development of your economy in a better direction. A better direction in the long term because it handles the climate threat, and in the shorter term because it can insulate you against volatile energy prices and improve the quality of people's homes and so on. So the crucial thing is that it's about how we respond to those shock moments. We're not in a situation yet where they are becoming so overwhelmingly distracting and resource intensive that we just don't have any choice but to constantly respond to the last thing. We still are on the front foot. We still enjoy that agency to shift in different directions in the context of instability.
There are a number of institutions devoted to assessing risk. Some are financial institutions, and they don't publish their results. Your panel last year included a group new to me, the Global Commission on Governing Risks from Climate Overshoot. What is your assessment of the international work so far on these issues?
That the risks are conceived too much in terms of quantitative projections. I'll give you an example of this, that there's a lot of work out there that says, for example, by the year 2100, under the highest emissions trajectory, the trajectory where we just don't even really get the emissions down at all, that heat will be so extreme that there will be a loss of labor productivity in, say, human of the order of 20%. And that is spurious precision, because I'm really not credible to be able to get that kind of a level of precision of how much labor productivity will be reduced in that kind of world. But it's also potentially misleading, because in a world in which we've not got emissions down, labor productivity in parts of the world, in all over the world, won't just be impacted directly by hotter temperatures, but indirectly through all sorts of other cascading problems like food prices and political instability and conflicts and so on. So one issue with a lot of this work is it needs to focus much more on a mix of modeling and quantitative measures with more storytelling and qualitative assessments, kind of pictures of what that work would look like, scenario planning, for example. And secondly, when we consider a world in which we may go above 1.5 degrees, we have to understand that it's not just a case of pulling some technological levers, of one lever that sucks down carbon from the atmosphere here and another one that might reflect some of the sun's rays back into space, so-called geoengineering. Both of those things are risky and in many ways unproven, definitely the scale that we would need. Instead, we have to focus on the things that we should always have been doing, which is reducing emissions through demand management, so wasting far less, improving insulation and so on, the kind of measures that will also help us create a more secure society. And by making sure that we are ensuring societies are more resilient. And those things are complementary. A society with better insulated homes, with more local involvement in, say, the food system and so on, will be ones that are lower carbon and ones that are more resilient.
Laurie, are well-known environment groups taking in your message? Can civil activism help us?
Yes, I think that in some ways, activism, particularly direct action activism, has actually internalized these types of messages. In fact, I've personally learned a lot from the messages that they have been using over the last few years. Let's take Extinction Rebellion, which had a huge impact, not just in the UK, but globally with its occupation of London in April 2019. Its message of tell the truth is a useful one, because that has to be an element of the resilience of societies going forward. A story that I sometimes use in the context of the UK is that the government, politicians, people like Churchill in the context of the Second World War, they didn't completely sugarcoat the situation that the country was facing. There were things that were covered up or reframed, of course, but there was still a clear statement that it was an existential threat to the country in the Second World War. And what that enabled was a connection between society, its lived experience, and what needed to be done, so that then that could be done. And it helped form part of a story that gave the country resilience as it had to go through that incredibly trying existential battle. And the focus of much of activism recently on that truth, for me, is an important part of how we build the type of resolve and resilience of that resolve into the future.
Your new paper with Henry Thropp and Susanna Sherman of Chatham House is titled 1.5 Degrees, Dead or Alive. What led to this report, and is more follow-up planned?
We did the report because we wanted to explore this doom loop dynamic, to make this warning that societies could be so bound up by handling the symptoms of the climate ecological crisis that they are derailed from dealing with the root causes, and that creates that vicious circle. And we wanted to use the example of the growing rejection of the possibilities for 1.5 as an example of that difficult dynamic, that as in that case, as we're heading nearer to 1.5, you have got people who are saying, well, it's it's dead now. Now, the scientists say it's still physically possible, but what's missing is the political will. I would slightly change the language and say, saying 1.5 is dead is basically passing your own judgment on the possibilities for the vast transformations that we need. And it's fair enough, I think, if some people have said, it seems to me that those transformations are possible, if not just because of understandable cynicism at the state of politics and so on. But in a world in which we, say, ditch 1.5 and don't have an alternative story that motivates that transformation, the kind of transformation that could still give us a chance of 1.5, then you're in trouble. Because then you're in a world in which we're not motivated to deliver massive change to our societies. More instability comes, which could further demotivate and so on. So we wanted to do the report to kind of use the debate over 1.5 as a case study to highlight that wider dynamic. And it is part of a wider project called Cohort 2040, which is looking at how we can support younger generations, mainly those in the millennial generation, to anticipate and be better able to navigate a rapid, equitable transformation of societies through the unstable conditions that we're already seeing and will increasingly see into the future, to make sure that that generation, as it passes into senior leadership in the coming years and decades, can break that doom loop and instead have a virtuous circle where moments of instability are galvanizing, where they are moments to drive more rapid and positive change.
That seems like a good place to wrap up. We've been speaking with UK researcher, author, and strategist Laurie Leyburn. Find his new report, 1.5 degrees C, Dead or Alive, at www.ippr.org. I will put links up in my discussion on the show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Laurie, it was great to talk with you. Thank you.
Alex, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
For Radio EcoShock, I'm Alex Smith.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Scientists and weather forecasters are worried about the next big El Nino. That is when Earth jumps up in heating, like in the 1997-98 heat and 2012, the record years. Did you know they also predict more El Ninos than we have seen and stronger extremes? That will play out in heat waves, wildfires, droughts, and big storms. But there's another hidden place of impact, Antarctica. From those massive polar glaciers to giant ice shelves breaking off, expect more sea level rise sooner than they told you. Naturally, the neighbors are looking into it. Our guest is Dr. Ariane Puric, and she's in the thick of Australian research about the Southern Ocean and Antarctica. At Monash University in Melbourne, she is a postdoctoral research fellow at the School of Earth, Atmosphere and Environment. She is also part of the Australian Research Council's special initiative called Securing Antarctica's Environmental Future. Ariane is co-author of a new paper finding El Niño events could change Antarctic sea ice and speed sea level rise around the world. From Melbourne, Ariane Puric, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Alex, thanks very much for having me today.
Most media is in the Northern Hemisphere, as you know. Most humans live there. Hardly anyone spends time on the rough seas of the Southern Ocean. So we don't hear a lot about it. And yet, some scientists think the Southern Ocean is a huge factor in the future world climate. What do you think?
The Southern Ocean does play a really important role in climate, and it has a really important role for a number of different reasons. So the Southern Ocean is a relatively small ocean. It's not as big as the Pacific Ocean, for example, which you might be more familiar with. But it's unique in the global oceans because it's sort of uninterrupted by continents. So it goes, you know, from south of Australia and it flows around south of South America and around south of Africa. So it flows all around Antarctica. And the circumpolar nature of the ocean means it has certain circulation characteristics. And the Southern Ocean actually takes up a huge amount of heat and carbon from the atmosphere. And so this means that it's sort of moderating global warming by taking up heat and carbon from the atmosphere into the ocean. So that's one of the reasons why the Southern Ocean is really important. Another reason is that Antarctica has a huge amount of ice frozen up on the continent. Over the Antarctic continent, there's about 4 kilometres of ice. And if this ice was to melt, it could raise global sea levels by tens of metres over sort of many centuries. Now, we're not expecting to see that sort of level of sea level rise over the 21st century, but we do expect to see some sea level rise. And this is where the Southern Ocean comes into play, because the Southern Ocean surrounds the Antarctic margins, and the temperature of this ocean interacts with the Antarctic ice shelves and can accelerate their melting, and it can increase the sea level rise. And so that's another reason why the Southern Ocean is really important in influencing sea levels, and these effects will be felt all around the globe. So they aren't limited to the Southern Hemisphere. Sea level rise will affect coastal communities globally.
Why don't we bite into your work with the Antarctic sea ice? It is in the news. CNN reports, quote, 90% of ice around Antarctica has disappeared in less than a decade. Now, they mean the ice in the sea, of course. And what is the current state of sea ice there?
Something that's very topical at the moment. It's been in the news quite a lot here in Australia. So Antarctic sea ice, as you say, it's different from the ice on the land. The frozen ocean water, but is also important because it plays a role in various components of the climate system as well. Surprisingly, for many decades, Antarctic sea ice was actually increasing, while in the Arctic, the sea ice has been decreasing for many decades, and that's quite well known. We see these iconic global warming pictures with the polar bear, and there's no sea ice, so the polar bear can't get any food. In the Southern Ocean, it's been quite different. So Antarctic sea ice was increasing for many decades, and then in 2016 a huge decline occurred. Basically, over the course of sort of 2 years, the amount of sea ice that had been lost in the Arctic over many decades was lost in the Antarctic. And then since 2016, Antarctic sea ice has remained low. And so at the summer minimum in sea ice coverage, we saw a record minimum last summer in 2022. And then in February this year, 2023, we've just seen another record minimum in Antarctic sea ice coverage. And this is quite concerning to us as climate scientists. Seeing this really low sea ice, it can have implications to ice shelf stability. For the sea ice, when it's there, it can sort of dampen waves and protect the ice shelves from storms. And when it's not there, like it isn't at the moment, these ice shelves are more vulnerable to waves and storms breaking them up and carving icebergs. And the sea ice is also important in driving the deep ocean circulation. And this is an important component of how the Southern Ocean uptakes heat and carbon, like I mentioned earlier. And so the fact that this sea ice is much lower than it previously has been is something that's really alarming to a lot of climate scientists.
Well, in another aspect that we've been following here on the show, it's also a factor in the Earth energy imbalance, because when you lose vast amounts of sea ice, you lose the amount of sunlight that would have been reflected back into space. Scientists call it the albedo effect. Has anyone calculated the amount of new energy being added to the Earth system due to drastically lower sea ice in Antarctica?
I'm not quite sure about the energy balance of the surface per se, but you're absolutely right that the sea ice is highly reflective, and so when it's there, it reflects incoming solar radiation back out to space, and when it's not there, solar radiation is absorbed by the ocean. I'm not sure about the actual calculation, but it is another important component.
Well, it's possible that calculation or study hasn't been done yet, and it will be interesting to see if it does happen. We know that melting sea ice does not add to sea level rise. That water was already there in the sea, and then it froze. Yet your work points to serious indirect connections between disappearing sea ice and sea level rise. Could you talk about that?
There's three types of ice around Antarctica, as we've been discussing. The sea ice, which is frozen ocean water, and it freezes and melts each season. And this doesn't raise sea levels. It's like if you have your glass with ice cubes in it. The ice cubes can melt and your glass doesn't overflow. But the other two types of ice that's formed on land when snowfall over Antarctica is compressed. And so we have the ice that's still sitting on the land, called the ice sheet, and then some of the ice sheet that has sort of slipped out over the ocean and is now floating over the ocean whilst still attached to the land as well, which is called the ice shelf. And the ice shelves also don't raise sea level themselves when they're not, because again, they're already floating on the ocean. But as the ice shelves melt, and they melt when they come into contact with warm ocean below them, and also when icebergs carve off them, as the ice shelves melt, they allow the land ice to slide into the ocean more quickly. The ice shelves form a buttressing support, a physical barrier to hold the land ice on the land. And when they're not there, the land ice slides into the ocean more quickly. And this is what raises sea levels. And so specifically in terms of sea ice, when sea ice isn't present, it can increase the waves and the storms beating on the ice shelves. And this can increase how quickly the ice shelves break away. And thus, this can increase the land ice sliding into the ocean and raising sea levels. Another really important way in which the ice shelves melt faster is through a warming ocean underneath the ice shelves. And you know, it's a complicated system considering the circulation of the ocean in these very high latitude regions. But how the sea ice interacts with the ocean circulation and influences how much warm water gets beneath the shelves is another important thing to consider. There's sort of not one clear way that it influences the melting, but, you know, changes occurring in the high latitude system all need to be considered.
We have science showing that the state of sea ice in the Arctic can affect weather, including rainfall, further south. Is that the case for Antarctica? Does sea ice decline affect weather, say, in Australia, New Zealand, or South America?
Oh, that's a really good question, Alex. I think there's a lot less known about the influence of Antarctic sea ice coverage on southern hemisphere weather patterns compared to the Arctic. There have been some studies that have shown that quite sort of substantial changes in the sea ice over the Southern Ocean can change one of the modes of climate variability called the Southern Annular Mode, or the SAM, which describes the circumpolar westerly winds that blow over the Southern Ocean, and they can move north or south as a sort of mode of variability. So some studies have suggested that sort of overall sea ice coverage can affect the SAM, and the SAM itself can affect rainfall and temperature across the Southern Hemisphere inhabited continents, so Australia and South America and Africa. But I haven't really seen this play out sort of in a more weather type context. These are sort of more longer term climate studies. Antarctica can have an important influence on the weather in Australia, for example, but I think there's still a lot of unanswered questions about the role of sea ice in influencing weather in the sort of regions north of Antarctica.
Recently, you were part of a team of scientists trying to understand the future of sea ice and ice shelves around Antarctica. Your team looked at another driver, the ocean heat system known as El Niño or La Niña, technically called ENSO. The paper published February 20th, 2023 is titled Antarctic Shelf Ocean Warming and Sea Ice Melt Affected by Projected El Niño Changes. Now, before we get to the results from your group's latest study, there is something strange. In the Northern Hemisphere, the deeper you go, the colder it gets, but not in the Southern Ocean?
That is a really interesting thing, Alex. So there's sort of much of the Southern Ocean, the northern part, the ocean, you know, just to the south of Australia. It is, as you describe, in the Northern Hemisphere, warm waters at the surface and then cooler waters as you go deeper down in the ocean. But at the high latitudes, so around the Antarctic margins, we have the opposite. We actually have colder water at the surface and warmer water at depth. And this might seem a little bit confusing because, you know, like air, we know that warm air rises. We can expect that warm water should also rise to the top. It should be less dense and it should be sitting on the top of the ocean. But in the Southern Ocean, we have these competing influences of the temperature of the ocean and the salinity of the ocean. And we actually find in the high latitude Southern Ocean that it's the salinity that really controls how the ocean is stratified. And so we have this cold and fresher water at the surface of the Southern Ocean and this warmer water at depth. And this is important for a couple of reasons. It means that if more or less warm water from the subsurface is upwelled to the surface, it can actually cause a surface warming. And so this can be sort of surprising. You think, more water coming from the depth, you would initially think that it would be colder, but it's not. It's warmer, so it can cause a surface warming. And it's also important because ice shelves, the big bits of ice that were on land but are now floating on the ocean, they can actually be quite thick. And so the ice shelves, the base of the ice shelves where they come into contact with the ocean can be for example, 400 meters below the surface, and they're in contact with the sort of warmer subsurface layer, not the cold surface layer. And so this temperature of this layer can be important in melting ice shelves, and changes in that can be really sort of what sort of determines an increase in the rate of melting of the ice shelves.
What is the science behind predictions that we will have more hot El Niño events in the future?
El Niño and La Niña, which are collectively termed the El Niño Southern Oscillation, or ENSO, have a huge role on global climate. It's the largest mode of climate variability, and it affects climate in all regions of the world in different ways. And climate models project that as the mean climate warms due to increasing emissions of greenhouse gases, there'll be an increase in ENSO variability. And so what this means is that there will be more extreme El Niños and there will be more extreme La Niñas in the future as the climate warms. And this happens because as we have a warming atmosphere, because we're increasing the concentration of greenhouse gases, it warms the surface layer of the equatorial Pacific Ocean. And this surface layer is warmed more quickly than below. We're back in the equator where the surface layer is the warmest layer of the ocean and below that is a cooler layer of the ocean. And so we have a warmer surface layer, and also under a warming climate, we have more rainfall, and this freshens the surface layer. And this, what this does is it increases the stratification of the equatorial Pacific Ocean. And so it means that the surface layer of the ocean is not sort of connecting with the subsurface layer of the ocean as much as it does under sort of current conditions or historical climate conditions. And what's really remarkable about ENSO is that it's a really coupled phenomena. So it involves the atmosphere and the ocean really coupling together. And when we have this more strongly stratified equatorial Pacific Ocean because of global warming, it actually increases the ability of this surface layer of the ocean to couple with the atmosphere. And this means that sort of this coupling gets stronger. And for a given wind forcing, the ocean can respond in a stronger manner. And this essentially increases the occurrence of strong El Niño events and strong La Niña events. So under global warming, we have an increase in ENSO variability in both El Niño and La Niña events.
Starting in 2014, Dr. Wenju Chai of the government science agency CISRO first published his findings of increasing frequency of extreme El Niño events due to greenhouse warming. And simply put, Dr. Chai is a powerhouse researcher in this field. He's been publishing for the past 25 years. He led this recent study. How did you get involved, Ariane?
Yeah, that's a good question, Alex. So I worked with Chai at CSIRO for a couple of years, and I also did my PhD sitting at CSIRO with Chai as my supervisor there and also a university supervisor. And you're right, Chai is he's a world expert at understanding projected changes in El Niño and La Niña. And much of his work utilises coupled climate model output. And this coupled climate model output is something that I also use a lot in my research, which largely focuses on the Southern Ocean. Because of this recent study looking at, you know, the influence of El Niño and La Niña on the Southern Ocean, Chai got in touch with me about getting involved in this study and sort of really looking at the influence around the Antarctic margins of these changes in the tropical Pacific.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
El Niño is the most extreme state of the Pacific cycle called ENSO. If the number of El Niño years doubles as we heat the planet, what impact does that have on Australia, which has already been slammed with years of extreme weather? I know this isn't your specialty, but you must have heard something about this.
You're right in that this isn't my area of expertise, but El Niños and La Niñas have a strong influence on Australian rainfall. And typically across eastern Australia, which is where much of the population and the agriculture in Australia is, El Niños tend to be associated with lower rainfall and drought, and La Niñas tend to be associated with higher rainfall. And in the case of the past 3 years, we've had quite a lot of flooding here. And so while this is beyond my area of expertise, we could suggest that if we have an increased frequency in extreme El Niño and La Niña events, we might be experiencing stronger extreme rainfall and drought years across eastern Australia.
Yes, from what I've seen, you could be going from flood to fire and back again in different years. Could you describe the processes where an El Niño taking place far away in the Pacific could hasten ice shelf melt?
Yeah, okay. That's a good question because it can seem quite complicated. There's sort of actually two different mechanisms by which this can happen, and I'll explain both of them because one of them sort of seems a little bit more tangible. And so when we have an El Nino event, so we have a really warm eastern equatorial Pacific, this changes sort of the atmospheric convection, and this sets off planet-wide waves in the atmosphere, and it can affect climate in a lot of different regions. And so what I'm most familiar with is rainfall across eastern Australia, for example. But it also sort of sets off this wave that influences the circulation in the southern Pacific Ocean near Antarctica in a region called the Amazon Sea. And so El Nino tends to be associated with a weakened Amazon Sea low circulation, and conversely, La Nina tends to be associated with a strengthened Amazon Sea low circulation. So this can really affect the winds sort of in this sector of Antarctica. But more broadly than just that, El Nino can actually affect the hemispheric circulation around the southern hemisphere. And so El Nino tends to be associated with, I mentioned before, the southern annular mode or the SAM. El Nino tends to be associated with a negative SAM or SAM-like wind patterns. And so the westerly winds over the southern ocean tend to weaken and shift north, whereas La Nina tends to be associated with a positive SAM-like wind changes over the southern ocean. The winds strengthen and shift south. And these changes in winds that occur both, you know, on a hemispheric level and also more regionally in the Pacific sector in the Amazon sea low area, these wind changes affect the underlying ocean. So a lot of the ocean circulation is driven by wind. And as you mentioned earlier, the southern ocean has this cool water at the surface and this warm water at depth. And changes in the wind can change the ocean circulation, which basically can redistribute the ocean heat. And so in this study led by Chai, what they found was that because we are projecting an increase in ENSO variability over the 21st century, so there'll be more frequent strong El Nino events and more frequent strong La Nina events. But because El Nino and La Nina are not exactly symmetric, we actually get left with a residual El Nino signature in the mean circulation. So we have an El Nino-like pattern. And this changes the ocean circulation in such a way that the warm subsurface waters around Antarctica stay in the subsurface, more so than normal. And what this means is it leads to a relative cooling of the surface ocean. And I use the words relative here carefully because this is under greenhouse warming. We are still seeing the surface will be warming. We do still see Antarctic sea ice being lost in these climate projections of the 21st century. But the role of these strong El Ninos is to slow down the sea ice loss and slow down the surface warming relative to a case without this strong El Ninos. And conversely, this warm water, it's kept at depth, and so we actually see an increase in warming of the subsurface. And this is really important for the ice shelves. So this warming happens at levels where the ice shelf cavities are located. And so if we have more warm water being kept at depth, it means that there's more heat available to melt the ice shelves from below. And ultimately, this is important because as the ice shelves melt, their buttressing support is reduced, and this means that the land ice can slide into the ocean more quickly and raise sea levels.
Recent science also predicts the Arctic will become a stormier place, and that can damage sea ice, among other things. The Southern Ocean is already legendary as too stormy for almost any ship. Do you expect there will be more storms in and around Antarctica as the climate heats up?
The Southern Ocean is a really stormy place, as you said, and one of the things that we have seen over the past few decades and that is projected to continue is a positive trend in the southern annular mode. And what this means is that the westerly winds that blow over the Southern Ocean, they've strengthened and they've moved poleward, so they've moved further towards Antarctica. And the storms are tied to these westerly wind jets, and so the storm tracks themselves have also moved further south around Antarctica, but I'm not actually sure about the number of storms, so I can't really comment on that exactly.
We're often told the ocean is absorbing both heat and carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, and the churning Southern Ocean is the largest carbon sink mechanism perhaps on the planet. If sea surface temperatures warm as predicted, and El Niños proliferate, could this change the carbon dioxide exchange? And if so, for better or for worse? Do we know yet?
It's a big question, Alex, and there's lots of different components. So I think understanding the ocean's role in carbon uptake is not my area of expertise. So I'm going to give some general comments, but they're cautioned with that. So part of the ocean's role in, or the southern ocean's role in uptaking heat and carbon is tied to its sort of mean state circulation. And this is likely to change under future climate because the wind can change this ocean circulation. And so changed winds could cause the ocean to uptake more or less anthropogenic heat and carbon. And what this means for us, we live on the land and in the atmosphere essentially. If the ocean is taking up less heat and carbon, there will be more in the atmosphere. It will warm faster. If the ocean takes up more heat and carbon, it will sort of dampen the influence of global warming per se, but it will lead to faster sea level rise as the ocean sort of warms up and expands, which is another sea level rise process in addition to the melting ice sheet. And it will lead to faster ocean acidification. As to what exactly happens, I can't really comment on that clearly today, sorry.
Melting ice from Antarctica could flood world port cities and heavily populated farming deltas, but most of our science and media attention has been on the Arctic, even though Antarctica could flood these places. Why do you think that is, and are we missing one of the most dangerous developing changes?
There's a couple of reasons. I think the first reason is that Antarctica is really far away. It's really far away to us in Australia. It's especially far away to you in Canada, whereas the Arctic is on your doorstep. And so I think it's quite natural in that sense to be focused on something that's happening closer to you. I did my master's at McGill in Montreal, and when I was there, Antarctica seemed, and like it was, the furthest place in the world. And it's hard to keep that at the forefront of your mind a lot of the time. So that's the first thing. And then I think the second thing is that these changes that have occurred in the Arctic have been going on for many decades now. And so they're quite well understood, and we've been seeing sea ice decline across the Arctic, for example. And scientists have a pretty good understanding of that. And I think this has infiltrated the public's understanding of the science. Whereas changes in the Antarctic have been different. We talked previously about the sea ice, that it increased for about three decades before declining. And changes on the Antarctic continent have also seen sort of differences. So there were some cooling trends on the Antarctic continent for a couple of decades, which have now been understood to be influenced by tropical Pacific variability. Like El Niño and La Niña, the tropical Pacific also exhibits longer-term variability, known as the interdecadal Pacific Oscillation, and that was shown to be influencing temperature on the Antarctic continent. But so, you know, for a couple of decades, the Antarctic continent looked like it was slightly cooling, and it seemed like maybe it might be protected from some of the influences of global warming because it's so remote and because of features of the atmospheric and oceanic circulation. But now that we have more understanding, we can see that these short-term changes were more like variability, and there's signs that Antarctica is not as sort of removed from the influences of global warming as we once thought. The East Antarctic ice sheet was once thought to be quite safe from ice shelf melting, and now we've got evidence to suggest that it is actually starting to melt in East Antarctica too. And this is really important because there's a huge amount of water stored in East Antarctica. And so, yeah, I guess these two reasons I think is why there's been less attention on the Antarctic. It's remote for everybody. It's particularly remote for people in the Northern Hemisphere. And we haven't had as clear trends as in the Arctic. There's been large variability in the Antarctic climate system as well. And so we haven't sort of necessarily seen global warming emerging as a driver of climate changes there for as long as the Arctic.
Is there anything else you would like to leave with our listeners as we wrap up here?
What we've discussed today has really highlighted that the Southern Ocean and Antarctica can play a huge role in driving global climate and in driving global sea levels. And so the take-home point overall is that it's really important that we consider changes that are occurring in Antarctica because while they are remote, they can have a strong influence on the globe. And specifically when considering this study led by Chai, you know, we're seeing how changes occurring and projected to occur in the tropical Pacific can influence the Antarctic ice shelves and the Antarctic sea ice. And what this is really telling us is that the global climate system is really complicated. And when we're considering Antarctic climate, we have to consider changes from the tropical Pacific as well as local changes to really understand them. And I guess what happens in Antarctica will affect all of us, particularly through its role in sea level rise. And so it's important that, we continue to focus research in this area.
From Monash University and Securing Antarctica's Environmental Future, we've been speaking with postdoc researcher Arianne Purek. Find links to all the science we talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org, published every Wednesday. Arianne, thank you for your work and talking with us on Radio EcoShock.
Yep, thanks very much, Alex.
Let your mind stretch around the planet. Become a global citizen, not just in humanity, but within the miracle web of life. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
Nature calls out from her wounded places. Humans walk about from our walled spaces. In dancing bodies, sparks jump from mind to mind. Hearts open just enough to hear that gathering storm of change. Hearts open to welcome news and prepare for the strange. Serious people gather to talk about air. Antennae sense the waves. Weather wears farmers down. Debt is the new currency. Worry the new anthem. But nature calls out, I was always here. Return to this womb that never dies. Dine in my temple. Find your core. But you can never return to the way that was. You can never return. As temples of power slip beneath the rising sea, you can never return to the way that was. You can never return to the place that was.
That's some far-out stuff, huh? Radio EcoShock, did you catch the true, it's embargoed till Wednesday. You do get the latest here at Radio Free Kansas. I hope you enjoy it. Coming up right now, the latest from Mariah Gilardin in Northern California from her off-the-grid home, TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, time of useful consciousness. Britain will send depleted uranium munitions to Ukraine. Annabelle Goldie, the British Minister of State for Defense, made this announcement last week on March 20, 2023. Britain already has sent the first Challenger 2 tanks to Ukraine, and the depleted uranium munitions are designed to be fired from these tanks. This announcement came just 2 days after the commemoration of the 20th anniversary of the Iraq War, where DU ammunitions were used on a large scale. The Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament has attacked the UK's decision. Kate Hudson, its general secretary, said, CND has repeatedly called for the UK government to place an immediate moratorium on the use of depleted uranium. DU munitions were used by the US and Britain in the Gulf War in 1991 and in Iraq in 2003. Their use has caused a sharp increase in the incidence rates of some cancers, such as breast cancer and lymphoma. Depleted uranium also has been implicated in a rise in birth defects in areas adjacent to the main battlefields. Kate Hudson says that the DU pollution will be long-term for many generations to come and can make agricultural land unsuitable for use. No treaty explicitly banning the use of DU is yet in force, but it is clear that its use runs counter to the basic rules and principles of international humanitarian law. In 2006, the European Parliament called for the introduction of a total ban classifying the use of DU as inhuman. Since 2007, repeated UN General Assembly resolutions have highlighted serious concerns over the use of DU weapons. However, four states have consistently prevented the adoption of the resolutions. They are Britain, the U.S., France, and Israel. Here now from Defense Updates, the news that the Challenger 2 tanks Britain is sending to Ukraine will be armed with depleted uranium munitions, followed by a report from The World is One News.
On March 20th, Annabel Goldie, the British Minister of State for Defense, declared that as part of an aid package to support Ukraine's ongoing war effort against Russia, her country would provide depleted uranium munitions. In January, Britain committed to providing 14 Challenger 2 tanks to Ukraine, and the majority of the training for Ukrainian personnel has already been completed. When Britain pledged to send 14 Challenger 2 tanks to Ukraine, it became the first country to offer Western-designed tanks to Kyiv. Later, under significant pressure from the United States and Poland, Germany also granted permission to supply Leopard 2 tanks, which are widely used across Europe, to Ukraine. Interestingly, Britain is now the first country to commit to supplying this type of shells. Defense Updates analyzes how Russia is so irked by Britain's decision to supply depleted uranium munitions to Ukraine. Let's get into the details. Depleted uranium is a byproduct of the process of enriching natural uranium to create nuclear fuel. It's considered less radioactive than naturally occurring uranium since it contains a lower amount of the fissionable material U-235. With a density that is 1.7 times greater than that of lead, uranium is exceptionally dense metal. This characteristic makes it ideal for applications where having a large mass in a confined space is beneficial. During the 1970s, the U.S. Army started producing armor-piercing rounds utilizing depleted uranium. It's also added depleted uranium to the munitions fired by the Air Force's A-10 close air support attack plane, known as the Tank Killer. Depleted uranium shells were used in both Gulf Wars and in Serbia and Kosovo. Over time, depleted uranium has also been incorporated into composite tank armor to enhance its strength. Since it's produced using low-level radioactive waste left over from the manufacture of nuclear fuel or nuclear warheads, it's affordable to produce in large quantities. Goldie was asked directly whether depleted uranium munitions would be provided, and she responded, "Alongside our granting of squadron of Challenger 2 main battle tanks to Ukraine, we'll be providing ammunition, including armor-piercing rounds, which contain depleted uranium. Such rounds are highly effective in defeating modern tanks and armored vehicles." There's a strong possibility that Britain intends to establish a precedent that would facilitate the U.S. and Germany in providing depleted uranium weaponry for their own tanks, which are also expected to be supplied to Ukraine. If the U.S. and Germany follow in Britain's footsteps, they could provide Ukraine with M829 APF-SDS rounds, which is compatible with the M1 Abrams and Leopard 2. The head of the Russian delegation to the Vienna negotiations on military security and arms control, Konstantin Gavrilov, stated on January 25th, "We know that Leopard 2 tanks, as well as Bradley and Marauder armored fighting vehicles, can use depleted uranium shells, which can contaminate terrain, just like it happened in Yugoslavia and Iraq. If Kyiv were supplied with such munitions for the use in Western heavy military hardware, we would regard it as the use of dirty nuclear bombs against Russia, with all the consequences that entails." Russian President Vladimir Putin stated, "If all this happens, Russia will have to respond accordingly, given that the West, collectively, is already beginning to use weapons with a nuclear component." Although Putin did not provide any details, the Russian leader frequently uses nuclear-related warnings, primarily as a means of convincing Western nations to restrict their involvement in Ukraine. Meanwhile, Sergei Shoigu, Russia's defense minister, said there were now fewer and fewer steps left before a potential nuclear collision between Russia and the West. Vyacheslav Volodin, the speaker of the Russian parliament's lower house, said rounds containing depleted uranium could lead to a tragedy on a global scale that will primarily affect European countries. Volodin said the use of such U.S. ammunition in the former Yugoslavia and Iraq led to radioactive contamination and a sharp rise in oncological diseases. Moscow also has its own Svenets 2 depleted uranium tank shells in its stockpile. The U.S. has come in support of Britain. White House National Security Council spokesman John Kirby said the ammunition, which enhances the ability to overcome defenses on tanks, is not radioactive and not anywhere close to going into the sphere of nuclear weaponry. He said this is a commonplace type of munition. If Russia is particularly concerned about the welfare of their tanks and their tank soldiers, they could just take them across the border back into Russia. I think that's what's really going on here, is Russia just doesn't want Ukraine to continue to take out its tanks. Britain responded by accusing Russia of deliberately trying to disinform. Depleted uranium has nothing to do with nuclear weapons and capabilities, the UK Ministry of Defense said, and said it was a standard component used by militaries, including Russia itself. The United Nations Environment Program has described depleted ammunition as chemically and radiologically toxic heavy metal. The IAEA, or International Atomic Energy Agency, says high concentrations in the kidney can cause damage and, in extreme cases, renal failure. While depleted uranium shells are technically not nuclear weapons, they are hazardous. The exploding shell can spread them in the air to over 25 miles, or 40 kilometers, and these can be easily inhaled in the form of dust. Depleted uranium has a half-life of over 4 billion years. Interestingly, Taiwan, which is getting M1A2 tanks from the U.S., has gone with tungsten carbide armor in their variant instead of depleted uranium armor. Russia has lost a lot of tanks and armored vehicles, and with modern Western tanks being transferred to Ukraine in the coming days, the loss could increase significantly, especially if depleted uranium shells are provided. Given the fact that these shells would be used on Ukrainian land, the main reason for Russia's concern is not environment, but the increases in penetrative power.
Hello and welcome to this edition of World at War. I'm your host, Mohammed Saleh. This week marks 20 years since the United States of America, under the then President George W. Bush, had invaded into Iraq. But there have been few wars in history that have been driven by a pile of lies, such as the invasion of Iraq. So what did the United States of America achieve by invading into Iraq? More than a million Iraqis got killed. Saddam Hussein's departure created power vacuum, which gave birth to the ISIS. And two decades on, the scars of the Iraq war are still raw in the region. And the irony is that even George W. Bush, in a Freudian slip, admitted that the invasion of Iraq was a wholly unjustified and a brutal invasion.
When are you going to apologize for the million Iraqis that are dead because you lied? You lied about weapons of mass destruction. You killed people. You lied. You lied about WMD. A million Iraqis are dead because you lied. My friends are dead because you lied. You need to apologize. Apologize.
This man is Mike Prisoner. He was one of the soldiers who was sent into the Iraq war by George W. Bush, and he confronted his former president at a convention in Los Angeles in 2021. On the 19th of March 2003, exactly 20 years ago, the United States began the invasion of Iraq with its shock and awe tactics. George Bush later admitted that his invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq were directed by God, was categorical in his threats.
All the decades of deceit and cruelty have now reached an end. Saddam Hussein and his sons must leave Iraq within 48 hours. Their refusal to do so will result in military conflict, commenced at a time of our choosing.
The American aim in the invasion of Iraq was regime change. And to this effect, the United States accused Iraq under Saddam Hussein of developing and hoarding weapons of mass destruction. Not everyone believed this American spiel. Thousands across different capitals in the world hit the streets to stop the mindless war. And as American bombs rained down from the sky, and the imposing statue of Saddam Hussein was brought down in central Baghdad, it became abundantly clear that George Bush's administration had lied through its teeth. 150,000 American troops, along with 40,000 British troops, had been sent in to fight in this brutal war that was based on a fabrication. Within 3 weeks, by the 9th of April, the Americans declared victory.
Major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
But the bloodletting in Iraq had just begun. Pro-Saddam factions began an insurgency against American forces. The power vacuum resulted in lawlessness. By 2004, the insurgency by the Sunni factions had intensified in Fallujah, while the followers of the Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr consolidated their stranglehold in the south. Images of horrific abuse of detainees at the hands of American soldiers emerged from the Abu Ghraib prison, drawing international condemnation. Iraqi novelist Sinan Antoon has a very pertinent question.
Especially Americans and those who supported the war should think, when in history did missiles and bombings bring democracy? Was there a precedent for that?
By 2011, over 500,000 Iraqi people had been killed. But the worst was yet to come. A bitter Sunni-Shiite civil war and a power vacuum in Baghdad created the conditions for the rise of the ISIS. And though the ISIS was eventually defeated, the vicious cycle of violence unleashed by George Bush's war continues to reverberate 2 decades after the lies were sold as a premise for an invasion.
The decision of one man to launch a wholly unjustified and brutal invasion of Iraq. I mean, of Ukraine. Iraq, too. Anyway.
Depleted uranium shells. You heard that right. Armor-piercing shells made out of depleted uranium is what the United Kingdom has offered to send to the battlefields of Ukraine. When Annabel Goldie, the Minister of State for Defense of the United Kingdom, made this statement, it knocked everyone's breath out. So what are depleted uranium shells? Is the use of this type of weapons even legal? Now, where have they been used in the past? From the very outset of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, analysts have been talking about the possibility of this war turning into a nuclear conflict. Because make no mistake about this, once these depleted uranium shells are used in the battlefield, Russia also responds ferociously with its own depleted uranium weapons. This war would have crossed the point of no return. Our next report gets you the details.
More than 100,000 soldiers have been killed on either side. Over 8.1 million Ukrainians have been uprooted from their homes and now live as refugees scattered in different parts of Europe. Despite this scale of human suffering, the possibility of a ceasefire to end this horrific bloodletting is not even remotely visible on the horizon. And now there is a new type of weapon that is all set to make its entry into the battlefields of Ukraine, depleted uranium. If the name depleted uranium made your heart skip a beat, then it should. First developed by the United States and the United Kingdom in the 1970s, depleted uranium is a byproduct that is obtained during the process of uranium enrichment. It is mildly radioactive. It has been linked to birth defects. It can chemically contaminate the soil. It can cause skin irritation, lead to kidney failure, and can result in skin cancer in people who are exposed to it. Depleted uranium was first used by the Americans on Iraq in the Gulf War in 1991. The Iraqi city of Nasiriyah was bombed in 1991 and again in 2003. Numerous infants born here to parents who have lived continuously in Nasiriyah are said to have been born with congenital defects. Besides Iraq, depleted uranium weapons have been used in Kosovo in 1999. Depleted uranium is 1.7 times denser than lead. Depleted uranium can penetrate straight through a tank's armor and erupt in a burning cloud of vapor. And when the vapor settles, it is poisonous and radioactive. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has hit back at the West. The use of depleted uranium, he says, will end badly for everyone.
This is a step towards further escalation, towards a serious and quantitative escalation. There were statements of some Western representatives saying that there was nothing scary about it, that the depleted uranium shells were not banned, that they were not breaking any conventions, but everybody remembers what results the use of depleted uranium shells had in Yugoslavia or Iraq, when tens of thousands of civilians and NATO soldiers who used those depleted uranium shells were affected. There was a spike in oncological and other dangerous diseases. The soil was poisoned for decades.
Presently, there is no United Nations convention that bans the use of depleted uranium, even though the United Nations nuclear watchdog, the IAEA, has repeatedly cautioned about the risk of radiation in depleted uranium weapons. The British Ministry of Defence has announced that it will send depleted uranium shells with the 14 Challenger 2 tanks to Ukraine. Russia, too, has a stockpile of depleted nuclear weapons. For 13 long months, the Ukraine war has been fought with the most top-notch conventional weapons. But what is now clear is that the fighting in Ukraine is now slipping into dangerous nuclear territory. Over 20% of Ukraine has been reduced to rubble. Food has run out. There is acute scarcity of drinking water. Thousands of those who have survived the carnage and have managed to flee to a safer place, have brought with them tales of horrific suffering.
I felt the temperature of my body going up so much that I thought I would burn alive. For a fraction of a second, I wished that the concrete slab above falls down on me to stop me from burning alive. This is what was going on through my mind in the fraction of the second after the explosion.
And despite this, the political leaders who are pulling the strings on the battlefield and are turning the screw on the next round of escalation appear to be dragging us down the abyss of a nuclear Armageddon.
That was a report from The World is One News, preceded by a feature by Defense Updates on the news that the Challenger 2 tanks Britain is sending to Ukraine will be armed with depleted uranium. Also from Defense Updates, a close-up view of the Abrams tanks that the U.S. will be purchasing for Ukraine.
U.S. President Joe Biden announced that Washington is sending 31 M1 Abrams tanks to Ukraine as part of Washington's continued support for the war-torn nation. Addressing reporters at the White House, Biden said, Russian President Vladimir Putin expected Europe and the U.S. to weaken our resolve. He was wrong from the beginning, and he continues to be wrong. According to the president, a Ukrainian tank battalion typically consists of 31 tanks, which is why that number has been agreed upon. He added, the Abrams tanks are the most capable tanks in the world. They're also extremely complex to operate and maintain, so we're also giving Ukraine the parts and equipment necessary to effectively sustain these tanks on the battlefield. In this video, Defense Updates analyzes why the M1A2 Abrams tank would maul Russian tanks in Ukraine. Let's get started. Abrams was first introduced in 1980 to replace the M60 main battle tank, which was introduced in 1960. The tank was technologically well ahead of most other tanks of its era. The U.S. military has kept on upgrading the tank to maintain its edge. As per reports, the Pentagon is planning to provide Ukraine with the A2 version in its exportable form. Importantly, rather than sending Ukraine tanks from its own stocks, as it's done with previous weapons, the U.S. has said it's buying the Abrams from the industry. The tanks are assembled in one place only, a government-owned General Dynamics-operated plant in Lima, Ohio. The facility can produce 12 tanks per month, but the line is now full of new tank orders for Taiwan and Poland. This could potentially mean they won't arrive on the battlefield for many months, but this is not such a bad thing, as Ukrainian personnel will need time for training. In 2016, the U.S. Army and Marine Corps began testing out the Israeli Trophy active protection system to protect their Abrams tanks from modern RPG and ATGM threats by firing small rounds to deflect incoming projectiles. It's unlikely that Ukraine-bound tanks will have them. Over the years, due to upgrades, the Abrams has got heavier. It's probably the heaviest tank currently operating at nearly 75 tons, but it can manage a top speed of 42 miles per hour, or 67 kilometers per hour. So even though the Abrams tank is heavy and bulky, it's surprisingly agile. It's faster than many other tanks, and has superior cross-country performance. This is mainly due to the powerful engine, which is essentially a modified helicopter engine adapted for use. The M1 Abrams powertrain consists of an AGT-1500 multi-fuel gas turbine, originally made by Lycoming, now Honeywell, capable of 1500 shaft horsepower, 1100 kilowatts, at 30,000 RPM, and a 6-speed, 4-forward, 2-reverse, Allison X1100 3B hydrokinetic automatic transmission. It's a multi-fuel engine, which can run on any grade of petrol, diesel, aviation fuel, such as JP4 or JP8, or kerosene. By 1989, the U.S. Army started transitioning solely to JP8. The engine is remarkably quiet. Due to this feature, the Abrams have even been nicknamed the Whispering Death. One of the most important improvements over the M1A1 in M1A2 is the M256 120mm smoothbore gun, originally developed by Rheinmetall and produced in the USA under license. This gun is loaded manually. Abrams has a range of effective fire in excess of 2.5 miles or 4 kilometers. The U.S.-made military vehicle is one of the most modern battle tanks in the world, but requires extensive training to operate. Provided that the logistics and maintenance are managed well, Abrams is potent, to say the least. In suitable configuration and operated wisely, Abrams will be tough for Russian tanks to take out. Firepower is lethal and has been developed keeping in mind that Abrams could face Russian tanks like T-90 in battle. If the Ukrainian personnel absorb the training well, then Abrams operating with Bradley fighting vehicles could not only thwart a Russian armored thrust, but also pierce Russian lines. Viewers may remember Abrams tanks rolled over enemy tanks, mainly of Russian origin, in Afghanistan and Iraq. While 31 is not a big number, similar to HIMARS, more could arrive in the coming days. So this development could certainly spell a lot of trouble for President Putin.
That was a report from Defense Updates, a close-up view of the Abrams tanks that the U.S. will be purchasing for Ukraine. You heard a report on depleted uranium munitions that Britain will send to Ukraine. The announcement was made on March 20, 2023. The first Challenger 2 tanks have already arrived, and with them the fear that depleted uranium munitions may get fired soon. The concern is now that the Abrams tanks from the U.S. also might have depleted uranium munitions on board. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org. TUC Radio takes its name from an aeronautical term. Time of useful consciousness is the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness, the brief moment in which a pilot may save the plane. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening.